What we have a problem with is that the Democratic Party's rule is now clashing with a state statute.
A fight over who can run on the state Democrat ticket. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the community of Aniak works to recover from a deadly shooting spree.
This is really kind of a gut punch for the community here. It hits one person, it hits everybody in a way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Doyon, the Alaska Native Regional Corporation for the Interior, got some bad news today. A panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled the FCC was right to deny bidding discounts worth billions of dollars to a Doyon subsidiary called North Star Wireless. Essentially, the court says Doyon's partner, a massive telecom giant, can't hide behind an affiliate to claim benefits intended to help small and minority-owned businesses. But as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, Doyon is claiming a partial victory.
Dish Network, a massive player in the telecom world, cleaned up at an auction in 2015 for spectrum, that is, the right to use the public airwaves for cell service and wireless internet. Dish coordinated with two smaller companies, and together their bids totaled $13.3 billion. Then, Dish and its affiliate said they only had to pay $10 billion because the smaller companies qualify for discounts available to small businesses. The late Senator Ted Stevens helped create the spectrum auction, and thanks to him, there's an exception that allows Alaska Native corporations to qualify as small. Federal Communications Commissioner Ajit Pai told senators at a 2015 hearing, the Dish-Doyon deal is outrageous.
To be frank, I'm appalled that a corporate giant has attempted to use small business discounts to rip off American taxpayers to the tune of $3.3 billion.
Dish owns 85% of North Star. Doyon owns a portion of the remaining 15%. But Doyon Vice President Sarah Obed said outside the courthouse last fall that Doyon runs the show.
Dish Network does not manage North Star Wireless. We do. And so that's something we're really proud of.
The FCC, though, looked into the contract and decided Dish really holds the strings. Dish has financial say, and the FCC says the contract terms pressure Dish's partners to sell their stakes to Dish after 5 years. The appeals court judges agreed Dish does play an outsized role in North Star. But the judges also say the FCC should have given the companies a chance to change the terms of their contract so Dish doesn't have control of the subsidiary. Doyon, in a written statement, says it's studying the decision and welcomes the opportunity to work with the FCC to resolve its concerns. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Alaska Democratic Party voted last year to change its rules to allow independents to run for its nomination for office. But state officials blocked the move. Now both sides are in court over the issue. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on each side's arguments.
The proposed change would allow the party to support a candidate without having the word Democratic appear on the ballot by the candidate's name. Alaska Democratic Party Executive Director Jay Parmley says there have been multiple times when local Democrats endorsed independents when there were no Democratic candidates.
We believe that there are certain circumstances where there are candidates who would like the Democratic Party's support, but they would like to remain as an independent. They are progressive.
Two examples are independent state representatives Jason Grant of Anchorage and Daniel Ortiz of Ketchikan. An independent, Margaret Stock, expressed an interest in seeking the Democratic nomination last year for U.S. Senate. Alaska has nearly four times as many voters registered as nonpartisan or undeclared as Democrats. State law currently requires that candidates for political parties' nominations be registered members of the parties. State officials cited the law in blocking the change to Democratic Party rules. If the Democrats are successful in court, it would open up the possibility that independent Governor Bill Walker could run in the Democratic primary. Parmley says the governor's race is not why the party made the change.
It could impact the governor's race, but that's not our intention. And our support of the governor, or possible support of the governor, could still take many different twists and turns. But this is just one avenue that may be available.
Walker said recently that he and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott plan to bypass the primary as independents. Walker didn't have to run against a Democrat in 2014 because Mallott joined his ticket after winning the Democratic nomination for governor.
As we know, sometimes things change during an election process. We certainly saw that last time. And so we typically don't say never to anything, quite honestly. But this is the path that we have chosen.
In court, the Democrats argue that a state law that controls who can run for a party nomination is unconstitutional because political parties have the right to choose with whom they associate. Alaska Assistant Attorney General Libby Bacalar serves as the co-counsel for the state. She says there are multiple reasons why the state opposes the Democrats making the change. Bacalar points out that there aren't any current independent candidates who have said they plan to run for Democratic nominations. In other words, the state argues no one has legal standing. And lawyers for the state have argued that the state has an interest in who is eligible to run for political parties' nominations. The state provides certain benefits to political party candidates, such as automatically giving nominees access to the ballot. Bacalar says it's the state's job to stand up for the law.
What we have a problem with is that the Democratic Party's rule is now clashing with a state statute.
One group on the sidelines that's watching the court battle with interest is the Alaska Republican Party. Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock says Democrats want to run as independents to win Republican-leaning areas.
Everywhere else in the country, Democrats are proud to run as Democrats and not saying, well, how can we slip one by the voters and pretend to be an independent when we know we're really Democrats?
Superior Court Judge Philip Pallenberg will hear oral arguments in the case on September 21st in Juneau. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The community of Aniak is struggling to recover from a recent shooting spree that saw bullets flying through town and left one resident dead and several wounded. KYUK's Teresa Katsarilis reports.
Aniak resident Joseph Yaska, age 29, is accused of shooting a woman twice in a domestic violence incident as she fled from a home in the early hours of Sunday morning. He then allegedly armed himself with an AK-47 assault weapon and shot into homes throughout the quiet neighborhood, targeting people on the street nearby. According to State Trooper Nicholas Hayes, residents heard three volleys of loud shots.
We were getting calls from all over the place of people reporting different things, seeing different things, and then people reporting being shot.
Yask is accused of shooting and killing Bruce Goder Morgan, age 24, while he was sitting in his truck. The woman he is accused of shooting is recovering from her injuries, and Hayes says she wasn't the only Aniak resident who was hurt.
Other people received injuries due to shrapnel, whether it was glass or actually fragmentation from the casing, but there was a lot of injuries.
He's added that while the initial shooting happened quickly, it took several hours to find the shooter. There aren't any tribal police, or village public safety officers in Aniak. A single state trooper, Anthony Wiles, was in town when the shooting started. His neighbors banged on his door at about 2 in the morning and helped him locate where the shooting was taking place. Wiles then evacuated residents from their homes and ultimately apprehended Yaska himself.
This is really kind of a gut punch for the community here. It hits one person, it hits everybody in a way.
Kevin Toothaker is Aniak's city manager. He says that Aniak's a tight-knit and thriving community, a place that many people find oddly healing. To have a shooting happen here, of all places, feels surreal. And Toothaker places some of the blame on the village's lack of law enforcement. He says he plans to write a letter to Walt Monaghan, Alaska's commissioner of public safety, about the situation, and is trying to figure out how Aniak could pay for police party's presence.
We just don't have a deep enough budget to really just say, hey, we're going to go hire a cop.
In the meantime, the troopers are continuing to interview witnesses, and Antioch residents are banding together. Yaska was arraigned in Antioch yesterday morning. He is charged with murder in the first degree, attempted murder in the first degree, firing a gun at a dwelling, and three counts of assault in the third degree, or threatening another person with a weapon. He is also charged with two counts of assault in the fourth degree, or recklessly injuring another person. Yaska had several run-ins with the law prior to this shooting. A short-term protective order was taken out against him last year and then quickly canceled. He was prosecuted on a domestic violence charge in 2011, though it was later dropped. The woman who requested the protective order against Yaska is the same woman he is accused of shooting twice on Sunday morning. Yaska is currently imprisoned in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Correctional Center in Bethel. His next hearing is scheduled for September 7th in Antioch. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an underdog takes first place at the state fair.
I didn't expect much out of this pumpkin because it was the slowest growing of the pumpkins I had.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A federal judge has thrown out a defamation lawsuit against the New York Times by former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin over an editorial. The editorial, titled America's Lethal Politics, was published in June after a gunman opened fire on Republican lawmakers in Virginia, wounding U.S. Representative Steve Scalise. The piece accused a Palin GOP political action committee of distributing a map depicting Democratic lawmakers beneath crosshairs just before the 2011 shooting of Democratic U.S. Representative Gabby Giffords. The newspaper issued a correction, noting that the map actually showed electoral districts, not people, in crosshairs. Today, Judge Jed Rakoff in Manhattan said there were a few factual inaccuracies, somewhat pertaining to Palin, that were rapidly corrected in the piece. He added that while it may have been negligent of the paper, it was plainly not defamation of a public figure. Support groups from Anchorage and the Matanuska Susitna Borough met on Friday to discuss addiction in Alaska. A recovery summit was held in Palmer. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha attended to learn how people in recovery are working with the state to fight the opioid epidemic.
Inside an auditorium filled with people whose lives have been touched by addiction, the state's chief medical officer runs through a list of what the Matsu Opioid Task Force has done to combat substance abuse.
It's bringing together law enforcement, teachers, it's bringing together family members who are impacted, and most importantly, people who are in recovery.
In looking for ways to curb drug abuse, the state hasn't always sought out input from people recovering from addiction themselves. Terrio Walters is the founder of Fallen Up Ministries, a group that provides non-opioid addiction recovery treatment and has worked with the Matsu Task Force. Walters is in recovery herself and has spent time in prison. For years, Department of Corrections policy has prevented her from helping people with a history of addiction as they left prison.
Somebody would say, I don't want you talking to Terria because she's a convicted felon and that's the policy, no felon-to-felon contact. Even if you did treatment with her and she's doing good, she's a felon. So the person that's going to help me the most is somebody that has lived experience and has been where I've been.
Walters says that a correctional system that punishes addiction has a negative impact on recovery. And many feel that the anonymity that's at the heart of support groups like Narcotics Anonymous perpetuates the sense of shame and stigma associated with addiction. Carl Soderstrom, co-founder of the support group Fiend to Clean, says that he wants to bring people in recovery out of the shadows.
What we're trying to encourage people to realize is that there's a lot of pride in recovery. You know, so we don't have to relive the past and we don't have to own our addiction. What we have to do is be proud of our recovery and share it with folks so that they can get out of their addiction and find recovery for themselves.
These days, groups such as Fallen Up Ministries and Fiend to Clean have become a point of contact for the state to reach those most affected by the opioid epidemic. In Palmer, I'm Henry Leisha.
Another remote property along the Middle Yukon River has burned. Alaska State Troopers report several structures at an unoccupied compound about 40 miles north of the village of Grayling were damaged by fire on Sunday. Grayling resident Douglas Deacon says the structures belong to the Thurmond family, but were used by locals for emergency shelter. Deacon says he and other members of a village wildfire crew were flying to Galena on Sunday and spotted the cabins, which appeared to had just recently caught fire.
We circled around to check if there was anybody around. We seen a person in a green canoe. He was out probably about a quarter mile downriver. He was waving at us. Hey, it looked like he was a bearded guy with a white beard.
Deacon says that fits the description of a drifter area residents suspect is responsible for the fire and another one that destroyed a cabin compound near Galena last month, as well as a string of burglaries at other remote cabins in the region. A blurry photo of the paddler was submitted to state troopers and posted to Facebook, where a commenter noted many people float the Yukon River during the summer and the paddler could be an innocent traveler. Other Facebook posts refer to notes left at the crime scenes, potentially linking the fires and break-ins to a particular person. Locals name the man they think is responsible, but trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters cautions no one has been charged and would not comment on potential suspects or other details, noting that the cases are under investigation. The Alaska National Guard is sending personnel and equipment to help with an ongoing rescue effort connected to Tropical Storm Harvey. On Monday morning, 13 members of the Alaska Air National Guard flew a cargo plane from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson to Moffett Airfield in California. They brought three inflatable boats and will be using helicopters borrowed from the California Air National Guard to conduct rescues from the air and water in Texas. According to JBAR's Public Affairs Unit, the group includes pararescue men, combat rescue officers, and combat support personnel. There aren't currently any plans to send more Alaska Guardsmen, but Jerome Bazemore with the 176th Wing says the unit is standing by if the call comes. Lots of Alaskans have ties to the Houston area, including climate expert Brian Brettschneider from our Ask a Climatologist segment. We asked him to help us understand the magnitude of the rainfall event from Tropical Storm Harvey and to clarify how much climate change may be contributing to the disaster. Brettschneider told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit he was living in Houston in 2001 when Tropical Storm Allison dumped 15 to 35 inches of rain on the city in 5 days.
My own home flooded, and I saw a home next door burn down from a fire started by the flood. So it is eerie to watch what's going on and actually how much worse it is than any previous flood on record.
Given how much worse it is than the flood you lived through, is it kind of hard to even comprehend?
It is. You can kind of go through the statistics, and which are just mind-boggling. The entire area where Houston is in Harris County has experienced the rainfall that would happen about once every 1,000 or more years for a large area. You know, sometimes you would see a little dot on the map where there's a small bullseye of someone who got just really, really dumped on a rain. But this is a large area. You're talking probably 2,000 square miles that have had a 1,000-year flood event. So it's really unfortunate, the placing of this this event. And you also have an area that's been heavily developed, is very flat, was historically wetland and boggy. And so there's a lot of human conditions that have contributed to the inability of that water to move out of the system.
And give us some Alaska context for just how much rain has fallen.
So if you think in Houston area, some areas have had a year's worth of rain in 4 days. So that's kind of, you know, imagine Anchorage getting 17 inches in 4 days, which would be twice of what has ever fallen in that time period. Imagine Fairbanks getting 10, 11 inches in a couple of days, which would be, you know, would far exceed any flood on record for Fairbanks. So it's these are really kind of mind-numbing statistics about how much rain has fallen in a short amount of time. And actually, if you take all that water, say that's just fallen on Harris County, 1,000 square miles, and you put it right over the urban part of Anchorage, it would be about 60 or 70 feet deep of water. So it's really just an extraordinary amount of water that's fallen.
How much of this storm can be attributed to climate change?
You know, that's actually a really tough question, and there's been a lot of hand-wringing about this. So, you know, it's pretty standard accepted atmospheric physics that if you warm an environment, it can hold more moisture. And so you would expect that any given event would provide a little bit more precipitation. As far as the, you know, was this a poster child for a climate change storm? You know, I think that's a really kind of a dangerous path to go down. You would really want to look at it as a probability event, as a population of storms. You know, so you say this is a little bit more likely in a warming world than it would have been pre-industrial warming. So I wouldn't say Harvey is you know, the future, but an event like this is just a little bit more likely than you would have seen, you know, in the past.
And in terms of how much more rain we're seeing out of Harvey because of climate change, you're saying that's a relatively small amount.
Well, again, it's really hard to attribute. You know, when you say a small amount, you know, perhaps. So instead of maybe some areas getting 50 inches of rain, maybe they only would have had 47 or 48, 49 inches of rain before. But that 1, 2, or 3 inches of rain, that matters. That's not nothing. So in the grand scheme of things, it may not sound like a lot, but it may be a significant contributor. But to say Harvey is a climate change storm, that's kind of a stretch at this point.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Call it the Goliath of gourds or squash supreme. The most prized pumpkin in Alaska has been picked. Weighing in at 1,231.5 pounds, the enormous creation of winning pumpkin cultivator David Isles took top honors, earning the first-time champion a $1,000 cash prize, a blue ribbon, and bragging rights. The Alaska State Fair's annual Midnight Sun Great Pumpkin Weigh-Off is certified by the competition's governing body, the Great Pumpkin Commonwealth, and follows the guidelines and the rules of the Guinness Book of World Records. A state official from the Division of Measurement Standards was at the fair to keep tabs on the weigh-off, which involves using heavy machinery to lift the gourds from the ground. Judges also look for cracks or soft spots, any kind of serious blemish that may disqualify an entry. Isles worried a bit about his pumpkin earlier this summer. He says it was not until a late push in the final stretch of the growing season that the pumpkin surpassed the others in its patch to take the win.
I didn't expect much out of this pumpkin because it was the slowest growing of the pumpkins I had. The other ones were off to a great start, so I actually cut part of this plant back to make room for the other pumpkins that looked like they had more potential. But you never know with pumpkin growing. Those wound up going bad on me. Kept this one, so just kind of a surprise.
This is the 12th year for the fair's Great Pumpkin Weigh-Off, which is its own separate event from the rest of the crop competitions like peppers, carrots, and the coveted cabbage contest. The 2011 weigh-off saw a pumpkin upward of 1,700 pounds, fourth largest in the world at the time, but it was ultimately disqualified because of a small hole. The state record was set last year at just under 3/4 of a ton. Bristol Bay's silver salmon season is winding down quick, with two of the major buyers wrapping up last week. As KDLG's Dave Benninger reports, keeping up with the fall fishing effort proved unexpectedly lucrative for the few who did so.
Silvers are not a tightly managed run in Bristol Bay, not like the sockeye that have counting towers and sonar and much more fishing effort. But area management biologist Tim Sands has been keeping an eye on the catches and the effort and says it has been a better year than most.
This year we caught 175,000 coho, and that's the second best since 1996.
The total Bristol Bay coho catch is somewhere around 210,000, but based on the number of buyers, some of the tally is confidential. Most of that came out of the Nooshigak district. The number of buyers quickly dropped to two main processors, Copper River Seafoods for the Drifters and Alaska Best Seafoods, buying set net fish at Ekuk Beach. Sand says it's hard to tell exactly how many people kept fishing, but it is clear it wasn't many.
We don't have a solid number on participation because we just see numbers of deliveries, but I would guess less than 50 people total, you know, and split maybe 50-50 between drift and set net. And, of course, some of those people might have only done it for a little bit, and others might have been going at it the whole time.
Lance Spencer kept fishing silvers at Ekuk, joining forces with John and Ina Bowker after most of the remaining crew called it quits after a record-shattering sockeye season. Spencer says 2017's surprises continued when this silver run got going.
I've fished silvers, you know, when there's been markets here and over the last 10, 15 years, and I haven't seen a run like this. The fish really showed up at some point. It was similar to the peak of the red season with the fish hitting the nets and nets loaded up and similar poundage on certain days.
Spencer says the work was steady for the small crew, which put away the pounds of silvers equivalent to a good sockeye season. Why more people don't keep fishing Bristol Bay's silvers is a mystery, but most attribute the sagging effort to a lack of reliable fall markets and ice. Spencer says the few fishing at Ekuk were really pleased to be able to sell to the new Alaska Best Seafoods plant that paid them 65 cents a pound for their coho catch.
You know, it started off with a little bit of complications, but ended up doing real well for us, and we're able to take all our fish and get it off the market.
The Nooshigak District remained open to steady effort for any who had a market and a desire to fish. Area Manager Tim Sen says there was really not enough effort to worry about not getting sufficient coho escapement.
The way I look at it is, 50 nets in the water and half of them set nets, the efficiency of that much gear can't even approach 50%. So if we caught 175,000 coho, then 175,000 at least went upriver. And, you know, the goal is like 120,000. So we're walking in tall cotton in that regard.
Sand says anecdotal reports from subsistence and sports fishermen have backed up his thinking that there was an abundance of silver salmon in the Nooshigak District this year. The Togiak District sees a later push of silvers, and there may be a week to 10 days more fishing there before Bristol Bay's salmon season is really done for the year. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes, Annie Feit, Henry Leisha, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. And thanks to Radio Free Palmer for helping with audio from the fairground today. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.